Later during the call, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone to speak with an operator. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host, Pam Gabriel.
Welcome to today's teleconference sponsored by the Beyond the Cure Survivorship Program at the National Children's Cancer Society. A child's illness changes a parent's life. Caregiving, even under the best circumstances, can be extremely stressful. During this teleconference, hear about the impact of a childhood cancer on parents and learn coping strategies for self-care. Parents who take care of themselves are better prepared to take care of their children. The information in today's teleconference, Parenting a Child with Cancer, Have You Hugged Yourself Today?, you will identify types of stressors experienced by parents of a child with cancer, identify issues of parental adjustment to a child's cancer diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship, list the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and discuss coping strategies. We are privileged to have Dr. Ann Kazak, Director in the Department of Psychology at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The vast majority of her work involves research and work with children diagnosed with cancer. I'd like to welcome Dr. Kazak.
Thank you, Pam, and hello to all of you out there. Good afternoon. I would like to begin my presentation by thanking the National Children's Cancer Society for inviting me to talk this afternoon. I'm going to cover a lot of material. I hope that listeners will jot down questions as we go so that we'll have time to have a little bit more dialogue at the end of this teleconference. I am going to make the assumption that participants have received copies of the slides and the handouts from my talk. In general, if by any chance you don't have them, for most of the slides you won't need them, but there are a couple of times with a couple of diagrams that I would like to refer to for you. So this afternoon, there's a couple of goals for this presentation. I want to start by identifying some key issues for parents. These are things that we've learned over many years of our work when a child has cancer, both the risks inherent in this situation and also the strengths that families bring to this. And this will be a theme throughout my comments, that our experience has very much been that families, children and families, are very strong and bring a lot to this situation, while at the same time are experiencing a great deal of stress and just distress. We often think about cancer as a potentially traumatic event, and we have learned a great deal about how we can help people if we look at the diagnosis of cancer in one's child and the events that happen thereafter as a potentially traumatic event. And I'll be saying a lot more about that as we go on. Throughout my presentation, you're going to see that I focus on the whole family. We're very family-oriented here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I will be glad to expand on that, you know, further in any, if you have any questions at the end. I also want to spend some time at the end of the formal presentation to talk about when and how to seek help, because I know that a lot of times people feel like maybe I should find some additional help, but I'm not sure how to go about that. And throughout, I sincerely hope to address your concerns and questions that you may have. As I mentioned, we think about cancer as a major life-threatening stressor, one that has both short and long-term effects for the child and the family. I want to emphasize at the outset that because of that, we think of distress as being a very normal response to learning that your child has cancer and to initiating treatment. On the other hand, sometimes that distress might come up at different points in treatment and even after treatment ends. So we consider distress to be normal, not necessarily comfortable and certainly not something that we would want people to experience, but definitely a part of the landscape of the experience that families are going through. As I mentioned, most families do cope well. It may be difficult. You can cope well but still experience a lot of pain and distress. We find over and over again in studies and in our clinical experience that there's really no consistent evidence for what we know in my business as psychopathology, or more serious forms of behavioral or mental distress. And in fact, we find many examples of adaptive coping and resilience as families find their way through this experience. What are some of the key issues in parenting successfully and taking care of yourself? And as Pam mentioned in the introduction, we really believe very strongly that taking care of yourself is good for your children. And a lot of times that doesn't necessarily make sense to people because they feel that it's selfish to take care of themselves. But really, if you're taking care of yourself, you will be in a better position to take care of your children. So we emphasize staying connected. One of the biggest risks for ongoing distress is to feel isolated. And it's very easy to feel isolated when you're under the strain of treatment and all of it that it entails. But staying connected, building those connections, letting people know that you need connection is certainly a very essential part of parenting. We also see a lot of disrupted relationships that happen within the family during the child's diagnosis and treatment, a lot of renegotiation of parenting roles, who's going to do what, you know, if one of us has to be back and forth to the hospital or one of us has to be staying home with a child who doesn't feel well, how do we renegotiate flexibly the kinds of things that everybody needs to do as a parent? We also see a lot of changes in parent-child relationships and oftentimes questions about things like discipline. You know, what is reasonable to expect from my child because they're sick? Should I tolerate more behavior problems because maybe they're not feeling well or maybe they're on medication that makes them a little more active or difficult to deal with? So a lot of changes, and there's no one right or wrong answer on those, but definitely an area in which discussion and thought is necessary. As I mentioned, we emphasize families here, and we see altered sibling relationships from the experience of cancer. Again, I'm going to say a little bit more about siblings later. It's not necessarily an entirely negative experience, but having a brother or a sister who has cancer is certainly represents a change for the other children in the family. There also tends to be a lot less time for the couple. And just as taking care of yourself is important if you are married or partnered, having less time for that relationship is certainly a change in one's life. And if you're a single parent, makes it even more difficult to garner the time and the resources to take care of yourself and to maintain a social connection. I want to say a little bit now about the fact that parenting, of course, does vary by age or the child's developmental stage. This is just intuitive, of course, because we all know that parenting varies by age, but I think is something to keep in mind when a child does have cancer. For younger children, we often see things like what's often called regressive behavior or clinging more to parents and other adults, sort of a stepping back from some of the more independent accomplishments that the child might have had before. Again, that's very normal. Along with that goes things like bedwetting and thumb sucking. We often see a reemergence of a fear of the dark, worrying about scary things around the corner and in the closet, things like that, trouble sleeping, and nightmares. With younger children, too, we often see just a general increase in crankiness and tantrums. So obviously all of these things make parenting more difficult at a time when you're also trying to assure that children are falling in line and getting their treatments and being healthy and the like. So it is a more demanding situation. For older children and teens, we similarly see reactions and things happening that often signal to us that these are going to be difficult situations for parents. These are things like changes in sleeping and eating, wanting to be alone, perhaps a social child who suddenly wants to be more alone, or a child who wants to be with you all the time, doesn't want you out of their sight, doesn't want you to leave, etc. We often see, again, an increase in irritability, sensitivity, talking back, whatever kinds of things that a child tends to do when they're stressed and upset, we tend to see more of. Some children will also express feeling kind of empty or numb or just not sure what's happening to them, a little bit withdrawn. Other children may feel overly self-conscious and worried, particularly as their appearance changes. They're going to feel that they look different, they look odd, and they may worry about or actually feel left out from peer relationships. So parents get upset too, not all about the children. And what do parents do, or how do parents show that upset? Sometimes it comes out in terms of being overprotective or feeling on guard, always waiting for the other shoe to drop in terms of wondering what's going to happen next. Parents often feel very upset when they see their child in pain or discomfort and have questions about how to handle their own emotions and their own discomfort in those situations. It's also quite normal to feel overwhelmed about your child's medical needs and all of the information that you're getting and all of the people that you're meeting. Not that different from children, adults are often find themselves having a shorter fuse, increased irritability, trouble sleeping, find that their appetite or their daily patterns are changing. Again, these are normal things and things to consider. Kind of how can I make sure that I can try to keep my life as regular as possible. Parents also are often upset because they worry privately that their child could die, and they don't want to necessarily share those worries with other people. And holding those worries in obviously can make them even worse and grow even larger than sharing it with a trusted friend or associate. Now, I want to talk a little bit about mothers and fathers. I'm not sure. That's funny giving a teleconference like this. You really have no idea who's listening out there, but I'm picturing some fathers, and I'm hoping some fathers, in fact, are out there listening. A lot of what we know is, quite honestly, based on mothers, because mothers are the people that we most often see in the hospital and clinic setting. They're often the parents who will sort of, when you say who is most hands-on in terms of working with the child and assuring completion of treatment, et cetera, it's often but not always mothers. But the experience of fathers during cancer treatment has not always been given the consideration that I think fathers deserve. We find that during treatment, parents may need to divide and conquer parenting responsibilities in a more rigid manner than before, which can make fathers feel sometimes even more, find it more difficult for them to find their rhythm in terms of parenting if they feel that they're sort of being relegated to being the breadwinner and that kind of thing within the family. We really encourage families to be as flexible as they can and take on new roles and understand that even if, for example, in the case of fathers who often tell us that they were very upset and they felt that they didn't have anyone that they could talk to because they had to go to work and they sort of had to be strong and they had to make sure that the family's income and insurance and all those kind of things continued, but that they still were having a lot of different feelings and reactions during this time. In terms of siblings, as I mentioned before, siblings also often experience distress, but like other family members, overall as a group tend to do quite well over time in terms of their psychological adjustment. Some of the common reactions that we see in siblings include some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress that I'm going to get to shortly: shock, fear, worry, sadness, helplessness, anger, and guilt. Siblings also express concern about the lack of attention that they're getting and the changes in the family. We've often found that siblings also often don't understand a lot of what's happening and are sometimes literally the last to find out, because parents are absorbing information, they're talking to grandparents, they're talking to extended family, and of course they're trying to talk and explain to the child with cancer, but it's often the siblings that are not quite sure of what's going on and hearing the information after a longer delay, which can increase their distress. Siblings also have issues in school. Sometimes we think a lot of times about all the challenges for kids with cancer going back to school and maintaining their schoolwork, but certainly siblings who are upset or distracted or feeling the, moving around or staying with different people and the like are also prone to have a little bit more trouble during at school, too. As I mentioned, I'm going to talk about positive outcomes, and one of the positive outcomes that I want to talk about is an increase in maturity and empathy that we see in siblings from having gone through this experience, even very young children and children who, say, in the 3 to 5 year range where we don't think of a lot of natural empathy and concern for others often do in fact show that, probably related to their experiences with having an ill sibling. If you have a handout in front of you, it's slide 11 that I'm going to describe right now. It's not numbered, but it's between 10 and 12, where I've drawn a little picture of how we understand what happens over time. And basically, if you think about time running along the bottom of a graph and the stress running up and down the side, that when a child is diagnosed with cancer, it's very natural, it's very normal for distress to increase. It goes up, and it stays up for a while, for some time. It's hard to say how much time that can be. It can be a couple of months, it could be a year. It also partly depends on how smooth the child's treatment may be and other things going on in the family. But over time, that distress goes back down pretty much to the level at which it was at before the child got sick. That's the normal, if you will, reaction. That's what we see most families doing. However, it's also not uncommon for some families where that distress stays at an elevated level. And in thinking about your experiences, and for those that are professionals on the call, sort of thinking about when do we need to do something more, I think about it as it's when that distress is staying up and is not kind of going back down. Okay. The next segment here, the next set of slides, have to do with things that you can do to help your child. And a lot of this really is common sense. It's about being a good parent regardless of what's going on in your family. I also want to, if you have the slide set in front of you, ask you to look at the top of the slide where I have put a couple of websites on the top, which are websites that we have developed here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that have tips and various handouts and materials that you may find helpful, both for parents and for healthcare professionals. So in helping your child, remember that you're the best person to comfort your child. I think that parents often feel a little bit uncertain about what should I do, what can I do, what's the right thing to do. Well, the right thing to do is simply to respond to your child the way you would naturally, to comfort them, to be with them. To show patience with your child, that they're going through a lot of new and experiences that are difficult for them to understand and they need patience. To help your child understand what's happening in an age-appropriate way that's also acceptable to you, to your family, to your culture. To encourage your child to share his or her feelings, to talk about what they are experiencing. And to remember that children have very active imaginations, and this is part of why it's good to get them to talk a little bit, because sometimes things will come out in the course of those conversations that you realize are the result of that child taking things a little bit further than they might, or misinterpreting something that's happening to them. It's also good to have your child think of the hospital staff as helpers, people who are there to help them. It's easy for young children in particular to be a little bit frightened of doctors and nurses and all the technicians and staff that interact with them, but to help them reframe this experience as people who are there for them to help them. Of course, young children may be upset about being left alone, and sensitivity to that issue is generally a helpful thing. As I mentioned, we talk a lot about taking care of yourself. I remember working with parents who just seemed so tired and exhausted and really needing those words of encouragement to say, you know, go out and, you know, do what you need to do. Someone can cover you for a short period of time. Or a mother who had broken her glasses and, you know, didn't want to take the time to go and get them fixed, but yet, you know, couldn't see right and was making herself more uncomfortable by trying to hang in there, that there are certain basic things that we have to do for ourselves. Also remembering that siblings and others around you may feel afraid about what's happening. They may feel worried. Siblings may feel jealous. Siblings in particular may feel jealous about some of what they perceive as their brother or sister getting additional attention. So childhood cancer also affects relationships not just within the family but between your family and your social world. And these are things like absences from school and work, changes in your social network, your peer, your community group, feeling disconnected from other families who you may feel don't understand what you're going through, and adjustment to being in the hospital. These are all things that add additional stress and strain to your experience. Now, we know a few things in general about what helps predict, if you will, better adjustment to cancer as opposed to more problematic adjustment. Some of these things are not necessarily things that you have control over, but they're things to think about. One are pre-existing problems, mental health problems, adjustment problems of people in the family. If you have a history of depression, you have a history of addictions, you know, this is going to be potentially a greater challenge than if you don't. How was your family functioning before? You know, were you doing pretty well? Were things getting done? Were you kind of, you know, happy with where things were, or were you really struggling? Again, that's going to affect how you get through the challenges of cancer. We look at the ability of families to mobilize and reorganize quickly. I talk a lot about things that have to do with flexibility and being able to shift roles and move quickly to do things that might feel outside your normal realm. Resources are important. They're not necessarily money. Money helps with many problems, of course, but there are also resources like social support, connections that you have, access to information, people that can help you. It's helpful in some ways not to have had a lot of other stressors in your life, but again, something that's not beyond your control if you've had other things happen to you or your family in the recent past. This may again be a little bit of a red flag for you to be aware that this could be a difficult situation. We tend to view an open communication style. People that can talk, can describe their experiences, can talk openly, and can listen well to others being a helpful factor. And also, as appropriate, a more optimistic and what we call efficacious, or kind of a can-do outlook. And sometimes people say, well, you know, there's nothing here to be optimistic about, and that in fact may be true at certain points, but we look for people who are still sort of looking at how this might work out in a more positive way, what good might come from it, how can I help do things to make things as positive as they can under these circumstances. I'm going to turn now and talk some about cancer as a potentially traumatic experience. I've mentioned a little bit about this already, but that cancer is a life threat. There are often repeated procedures that are uncomfortable. There's feelings of helplessness, disruption, uncertainty, and ongoing medical concerns. It's not a one-time traumatic event, but potentially several things going on over time. If you have the slides in front of you on slide number 19, I have listed some of the terms that you might hear, particularly now with the war going on, and you may be hearing more about post-traumatic stress disorder in general. That is a diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or the DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association. We differentiate that from post-traumatic stress symptoms, which are symptoms of PTSD, but they're not necessarily at the level of a diagnosis of PTSD. And finally, I also wanted to mention post-traumatic growth, which is a newer concept, but the idea that is here that positive outcomes can come related to having gone through traumatic events. The symptoms of post-traumatic stress include re-experiencing, which people often know as flashbacks, when thoughts about cancer or memories about it just come back to you unexpectedly, can be also seen in the form of distressing dreams, feeling that the event is happening again, getting upset when you see reminders of childhood cancer or of the hospital, and physiologic reactions, increased heart rate, etc., when you are reminded of the cancer. So many, many people tell us that they have re-experiencing symptoms related to their child's treatment. Avoidance is another symptom of traumatic stress, where people say try to avoid thinking, feeling, or talking about their experience. They may avoid activities or places that remind them of it. Sometimes avoidance can actually result in people not being able to recall some aspects of what's happening to them, and sometimes people think that's a little strange or unusual, but it is in fact part of a traumatic stress reaction. People may also become less interested in activities, a little bit more detached from people and from their life, show a different or what we call a restricted range in their emotional responses, and sometimes have a sense of a foreshortened future or an inability to think beyond the short term. Another set of symptoms of traumatic stress are arousal, and these are things, physiologic arousal, these are things like having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, being irritable, being angry, physical symptoms such as sweating, heart palpitations, upset stomach, difficulty concentrating, hypervigilance, or sort of always being on the alert, and having an exaggerated startle response. So again, parents tell us we see this very common to see these symptoms, particularly in the weeks and months after learning one's child has cancer. These symptoms, as I mentioned, can happen right at the point of diagnosis or can persist beyond a month. A lot of times what we're asking when we talk to people about this is whether or not these symptoms are getting in the way of your daily functioning. I included a quote from a book by Hamilton Jordan on slide number 24, if it's in front of you, and I'll just read it briefly because I think it's a strong example of a traumatic stress response that Ham Jordan reported when he learned that he had cancer. "I felt like someone had suddenly pulled a plug and all the energy and feeling were flowing from my body. I had a surreal sense of standing apart from this bizarre scene and watching myself sitting in the examination room talking with my doctor." As I've mentioned, we found across a number of studies that particularly mothers and fathers of childhood cancer survivors, as well as patients currently in treatment, have elevated post-traumatic stress symptoms. I'm not going to dwell on these findings in this presentation, but if people would like to ask more questions about it later, I'd be glad to answer questions about it. We do find, by the way, that post-traumatic stress is associated with family functioning, with how you're doing. It's hard to be as effective as a parent or as a partner if you're having a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms. We've also found that post-traumatic stress is not associated with the objective characteristics of your child's disease or treatment. And this is sometimes doesn't make sense to people because they'll say, well, I don't understand why I'm having so many so many of these symptoms right now. My child is doing quite well, and, you know, things could be worse, things were worse, and why am I having this? And we simply find that it's really not, it's not related to that, so that it's not unusual to see symptoms or distress crop up at different points. I want to talk a little bit about some of the approaches that we use in our intervention treatments that we've developed here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We have a program which is called the Surviving Cancer Competently Intervention Program, or SCIP. And this is a treatment model where we work with families to identify what their upsetting memories or adversities are about their child's treatment. And we've done this with mothers, fathers, survivors of childhood cancer, and siblings. We use a model called the ABC model, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that briefly, and a tool called reframing to help people identify what's upsetting them and how they might build new beliefs to help themselves feel better. So what are beliefs? Beliefs are ways that we think that help us interpret and analyze events. And beliefs are linked to emotional responses. So some beliefs will decrease emotional express. These are beliefs along the lines of, you know, I'm going to be able to get through this. I think that my child is handling things quite well. Other beliefs increase emotional distress, things like we're never going to be the same. We're never going to get through this. This is something that we're not going to be able to handle, etc. So beliefs influence how people in the family understand and respond to what's happening to them, specifically around their child's illness. Family members may have different beliefs, and this is perfectly normal and sometimes the source of some distress, because people would say, well, I don't understand why my husband or wife doesn't see things the same way that I do. Family members also influence one another's beliefs, and you do have, of course, the ability to sometimes shift how someone is seeing things based on your influence on their beliefs. And on other times, you're not so successful perhaps in trying to do that, but people do have different beliefs. On slide number 31, we introduce the ABC model. ABC stands for adversity, beliefs, and consequences. We ask people to think about what are some of the adversities that they've had in their experience with their child's health. So things like learning that their child has cancer. Then what are the beliefs that they have about that experience? One set of beliefs may be the doctors know what they're doing, we're going to be able to mobilize and handle this. Other beliefs may be less positive, like cancer is a death sentence, we're going to have a great deal of difficulty getting through this. Consequences can be feelings, both positive and negative feelings, behaviors, things that you do, and ways that you relate to people. The next slide, on slide 32, we draw this out to show the arrows between adversity, beliefs, and consequences. A lot of times people think, well, something bad happened to me and I had a consequence. I learned my child had cancer and I got upset. What we introduce with the ABC model is the idea that the things that you think about or the beliefs that you have come between the A and the C, if you will. So then we move on and talk to people to say, reframe. You know, can you reframe? Can you change your beliefs to change your reactions? How can you do this? This sounds much easier than it really is in real life, and not something that can be done quickly or easily, but you change your beliefs by doing things like accepting the uncontrollable. I can't possibly know the outcome of what's going to happen for my child's treatment right now. Focus on the controllable. I can make sure my child gets treatment. I can make sure that we still find a way to have a good time as a family and whenever we can. You can acknowledge your strength. You're a good parent. You're taking care of yourself. You're taking care of your family. You're doing the best that you can. And relatedly, use the realistically positive aspects of the situation to try to help yourself and your family. Reframing is a very natural process. If you think about it and if you take the ABC model and apply it to something easier in your life than your child's illness, you'll see that you can, that it's quite natural to do, but that it's very difficult to do when you're under stress. On the next slide, we provide you here with an example of a worksheet that we actually use with parents to help them identify ways that they use the positive, focus on the controllable, accept the uncontrollable, and acknowledge their own strengths. The next slide after that is an example of some ways in which we encourage families to talk with one another and to listen. And again, if you have this this diagram in front of you, what the important part about it is that in some of the group that the work that we do with groups of families, we have a group of mothers or a group of fathers or a group of siblings or survivors talk about how cancer affects their family, and everybody else listens. And then after they finish talking, the people who've been listening have a conversation about what they heard. So a lot of times what we're trying to do is encourage families both to talk within their family, but to also get a sense of what other families are saying. We also use the analogy of a journey in a lot of our work. And on slide 37, I have a picture of a little map that we use with families. And we sort of talk about how this is an unfamiliar journey that you're on. And there are places where you go round and round in circles. There are bumps in the road. There are sometimes, you know, outright roadblocks. There's no map. You get a road map for your treatment, but you don't get a road map for the emotional and behavioral aspects of this experience. So how can you help yourself and your family? Similar to working with your child, we suggest that everybody be patient and give folks time to adjust. Sometimes people say, well, I don't understand why you're still upset. That was 2 months ago. Sometimes that just is an irrelevant concept. Help your family understand what's happening. Again, the conversation, the revisiting what's going on is important, particularly for children who often learn from repetition. Encouraging your family to share their feelings, keeping as many routines intact as possible, and setting normal limits with your child and with other people just as you would ordinarily. Helping your child do things on his or her own, again, much as you would if they weren't sick. Encouraging your child to spend time with friends when they're able to. Taking the time to deal with your own feelings is also important. And following up with the treatment team and maintaining a dialogue with the people caring for your child is also a good way to help yourself. Okay, the last part before we open this this meeting up for questions, I want to talk a little bit about taking care of yourselves and how and about getting help. In general, we ask people to think about the ways that you use naturally to reduce anxiety. What's natural for you and your family? Do you like to exercise? Are you more inclined to try to relax, to do yoga, to go to movies, to cook, to do things? You know, what are the things that naturally reduce your anxiety? Those are going to be things that are still important to try to maintain. Seeking information is important, although I want to emphasize it's not for everyone. Probably many of you have scared yourself by seeking information, particularly accessing things on the internet and talking to people. So how do you modulate that so that you're getting enough information to feel informed but not overwhelmed, or not potentially running into information that may not apply to you or your family? Again, revisiting the idea of staying connected with people is very, very important, with family, with friends, with your community. Finding a way to do that, even in the busiest of times, is very important. And as I mentioned before, working to establish and maintain working relationship with your treatment team is very helpful. Now, asking for help is a good thing to do. Almost everyone needs some help and support during a time like this. We live in a culture where this is not always acceptable. And I want to really encourage people to just sort of to normalize this and to say that asking for help is important. It's for you, and it's important for your child, because the better that you feel and the stronger that you feel going through this, the better your child will subsequently feel. If you're reluctant to ask for help, you might want to ask yourself why that is, and talk even with someone about why you're not sure whether or not to seek help. I want to emphasize that asking for help does not mean that you're crazy. It could mean quite the opposite. It could mean that you're very grounded and you know that you're feeling overwhelmed and in need of some additional support. In terms of where to get help, your hospital may provide psychosocial support. There are often trained professionals on staff. They are admittedly focused primarily on children, but they're very accustomed to working with families as well, and may be able to help you provide enough support to be helpful in and of themselves, or to help you connect with others who could help you. These include social workers, child life specialists, pediatric psychologists, or chaplains. Many hospitals also have parent or parent-to-parent peer support, or what we call here at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, family faculty, who are family members who are actually on staff or who work at the hospital specifically to help families and to be a bridge between families and staff as needed. There are many, many family-centered care resources available at many, if not most, hospitals. And again, more variable perhaps from hospital to hospital, but the opportunity for groups, programs, and information about additional resources. I do encourage people not to try to self-diagnose themselves. You may be saying, oh, maybe I have post-traumatic stress. It really is a good idea to go to see a professional to sort through and make sure that the concerns that you have are being addressed in an optimal manner. If you're looking for help, I recommend strongly to get referrals from family, friends, community contacts, your medical team. A much preferred strategy over, in the old days, going to the phone book or going to the internet, but good to get someone who knows someone to start. Most states also have online listings of licensed psychologists, social workers, counselors, and psychiatrists. And this is important because you want to know that the people that you're considering going to have the appropriate credentials to be helpful. If you call someone for an appointment, it's fine to interview them, to ask them to call you back and to interview them and ask them if they have experience in dealing with the type of situation that you are facing. Not everyone has. And if an ethical therapist will not agree to see you if they don't feel that they have the expertise to be helpful. I recognize very well that reimbursement for mental health care is often not well covered by insurers. I do encourage people to really pursue options for this and in the long run to understand that it may be worthwhile to pay out of pocket if you have to for good help from the right person. Again, not to trivialize the expense of this, but to just say that sometimes I've seen families struggle with seeing someone who's in their network or within their HMO who may or may not be the best person, when a couple of sessions with someone on the outside with more expertise in the area might have been very helpful to them. There's many, many different types of evidence-based practices out there. It's beyond the scope of this type of presentation to attempt to address all that, but to basically say there's therapy, or talk therapy, if you will, is very helpful in reducing isolation and understanding options and how to take steps to feel better. Some of the types of therapies that you'll hear about are cognitive behavioral therapies, couples therapy, and family therapy. If you're having severe symptoms and persistent symptoms, you may also wish to consider medication, for which I recommend a consultation with a psychiatrist. Regardless of who you see, a sense of trust and connection is very, very important. So in conclusion, I wish to just highlight a couple of points that childhood cancer affects the whole family, may be thought of as a series of traumatic events, that most families ultimately cope quite well with their experiences, that there are many different reactions that family members may have, and there are many, many different ways to support yourself and your family through this experience. I would be glad to address questions at this point, and I guess, Pam, I turn this back over to you now.
Thank you, Dr. Kazak. Before we begin the question and answer segment of the program, I'd like to share some information about the National Children's Cancer Society and its survivorship program, Beyond the Cure. Since 1987, the National Children's Cancer Society has been a valuable resource to children with cancer by assisting with medical and non-medical expenses associated with a cancer diagnosis. As more children successfully complete treatment, the NCCS has accepted the challenge to meet the medical, emotional, and social issues faced by survivors and their families. Beyond the Cure is a comprehensive survivorship program offering advocacy, educational programs, college and vocational scholarships, print material, and emotional support, all vital program services to assist survivors in living longer, healthier, and more productive lives. For more information on childhood cancer survivorship, please visit our website at www.beyondthecure.org. There you will find a wealth of information related to survivorship issues. In addition, previous teleconferences on medical concerns, learning and school-related issues, health insurance and nutrition, among other important topics, are available for you to listen to. Each of you should have received a packet in the mail regarding today's teleconference. Your packet includes an evaluation form. We are very interested in your feedback on the program and hope that you will take the time to complete and return the evaluation. We're now ready to begin the question and answer segment of our teleconference. It would be appreciated if you'd limit your call to one question. I would also like to remind our participants that your individual questions will be heard by all listeners. Therefore, please do not disclose any information that you do not want the rest of the audience to hear. Now, Daniel, will you please tell our listeners how to call in?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question is answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key to do so. Our first question comes from Dawn.
Hi. My daughter is 18. She was diagnosed when she was 11 with AML. We had a terrific support system at the hospital. They were great. But we had a huge problem with the school reentry program. Not the program, but the experience. And she developed post-traumatic stress symptoms during that. So what I'd like to know, are there any studies being done to demonstrate the effects of the positive and the negative experiences of these kids going back to school?
I'm not sure completely if I understand your question. She had difficulty going back to school, and that may have triggered some post-traumatic stress, is that?
Well, actually, what happened is that when she returned to school, they were very insensitive, and they violated doctor's orders. She was put into several situations where her life was put in danger. Like, she had a port and a fever, and there was no nurse. They sent her back to class. And she's having anxiety attacks. And they basically told her, suck it up and get over it. Mm. So they were not a very supportive environment for her. And I wound up having to get her out of there and put her in a different school. But, I know that I'm not the only one that has had difficulties. So I was just curious if there's any progress in this area.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, first of all, of course, it's unfortunate that you know, you had to do that, but you were, sounds like you were being a good parent and, you know, getting her into a better environment. I would hope that that environment made a difference in terms of how she was feeling.
Definitely.
You know, I realize I was only able to provide a very, you know, brief overview, but some of the ABC model and that I presented is based on cognitive behavioral therapy, and we have found that helping survivors recognize and identify what their traumatic memories are and working through them using a model like that has been helpful for them. So I think the overall answer to your question is yes. I mean, as an 18-year-old, she, you know, is probably at a great age to start to put some of that together, because she's also, you know, entering a phase of being more independent.
Yeah, she's doing a lot better.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Sure.
And thank you for everything, because I read on a lot of stuff about you, and I know you've been doing this a while, and I think it's great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Delana.
Hi.
Hi.
My son was diagnosed when he was 5, and it's been 5 years that he's been cancer-free.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm finding is that this past year, I've been struggling a lot with what I feel, and there we go with self-diagnosing, but what I feel as post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
Can it affect you as late as 5 years later?
Absolutely.
Because I'm not a very emotional person, and, you know, as far as showing my emotions, and I'm being the oldest in my family, I've always been the one that's grabbed the bull by the horns and made sure everybody else was taken care of and kept myself, my needs, to mm-hmm. the back burner. But I found this year I have just, I mean, mood swing. I just, everything you described, I see it written on the wall there.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not a logical process. You know, I mean, I don't know how else to say that many of the studies that we've done have looked at people from shortly after treatment ends to 10 years out. And we've had people even further than that in our studies. And I would say that that this is not, it's not surprising. And it's not too late to get help, you know. It's sometimes people feel like, you know, I think it took me 5 years for this to hit me, you know, that I sort of finally kind of got to the point where you might be letting down your guard a little bit or something kind of, you know, creeping in there and triggering this. So I would say I'm not surprised, and I would encourage you to, you know, to talk to someone and try to get some help for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Our next question comes from Karen.
Yeah, this is Karen. I have a little grandson that was diagnosed with JPA, juvenile pyelocytic astrocytoma,
mm-hmm.
Last year, and he's went through his chemo, and he's got a MRI coming up tomorrow, and then another one next Wednesday. And I find myself getting real anxious before any of the tests. They got 85% of the tumor out at the thing, and some of it shrunk, but some of it's still there. But my question is it normal, both me and my daughter, find ourselves not wanting to listen to anybody's problems? We just, it's like, you know what, I've got enough on my plate, and even though you are important to me, like a sister or my mother or someone, I just don't want to listen to any of your, and excuse my language, any of your bitching or complaining,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to hear any of it.
mm-hmm. Absolutely, your plate's full.
Yeah.
You know, your plate is absolutely full, and I mean, I think that, you know, this is a time in your life when you need to turn, you know, to turn a little bit more inward and take care of yourself, and, you know, you're just putting one foot in front of the other until you get those test results.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's not like you can really perhaps even be that helpful even if you wanted to.
Right.
You know, that there's so much going on. So, I mean, I think that this is a time when if you know, people, if it's not obvious to people, sometimes you even have to just sort of tell them and say, you know, I'm sorry, I just can't. I want to hear about this, but maybe in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't. I can't do this right now. You know, I love you, but I'm overwhelmed right now, and you know, not try to pretend that you can do that. And I think that's part of what, when I describe that, people feel a little bit more detached. You know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's just kind of like I'm. All my resources are going into keeping myself together right
yeah.
now.
Well,
you know, and it,
yes.
I'm sorry if it looks detached to you, but this is what I'm doing to get through this from day
yes,
to day.
Yes, because I don't mean to feel look yeah. insensitive to anyone else's problems, but I can actually say this is my only grandchild, the only one I'll ever have. I am just obsessed.
Absolutely, of course. Good luck to you with the tests.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Our next question comes from the line of Diane.
Hi, Dr. Kazak. It's Diane Moore.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi. Good.
As you know, my daughter Colleen died in June 2008 from mm-hmm. osteosarcoma after mm-hmm. just a 9-month battle. And I'm now the founder of an organization to provide funding for children, for emotional needs for children with cancer called mm-hmm. Striving for More.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'm finding, and I'm just curious, and this was an excellent speech and excellent resources, and I really got a lot out of it that I think a lot of parents can use. But one of the things that I find a lot of people coming to me for is the word that survivor that's being used, and I'm just curious, is that, because, for example, like in our situation, my daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 terminal 4 days after she was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. I mean, she already had metastasis to both lungs and to 4 distant bone sites, and I'm finding, you know, I had a person call me from St. Baldrick's Association that a parent had contacted her, and she was in the same situation, and she was really finding a lack of resources because so many of the emotional type things on the web were referring to survivors, childhood mm-hmm. cancer mm-hmm. survivors. Is that just a general term that's being used for patients?
Mm. Well, you know, I think you raise a good point because, I mean, you're a survivor.
Yes.
And the rest of your family is a survivor. And I think that, I mean, I'm realizing in this that I didn't, you know, sort of focus my comments towards people who whose child have not survived, but that we do think about the family surviving. Regardless, the cancer community, I think in general, both adult and child, has latched on to the word survivor, not just the long term, you know, the 5-year mark, but the idea that, you know, as long as you're, you know, you can be one day out from your
okay,
diagnosis.
Okay, so even if it's the 3-month
survivor,
journey,
so
you're
I think
surviving
it's
for the 3 months.
Yeah, that it's,
okay.
That it's but it doesn't, you know, I think quite frankly it doesn't always ring true to people.
Yeah,
you know,
I think
and
that
you focus on that 5-year point,
yeah.
and if you're right from the beginning, you know, given the, you know, the solemn news that, you know, it's unlikely that you would get there, of course, it's
right.
not going to be something that you can relate to.
Right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you. I was wondering how your
work's
going.
Yeah, I'll be in touch and
okay.
we'll talk to you.
All right, good.
Okay. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
We're going to have to conclude our question and answer segment. I'd like to remind listeners to please visit our website at www.beyondthecure.org for the current list of our upcoming events, teleconferences, and to register for future programs. After January 1st, we will be posting the applications for the 2010 Beyond the Cure Scholarship Program. Please watch for information as it becomes available. I'd like to thank Dr. Ann Kazak, and thank you to our listeners.
You're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance in today's conference. This does conclude today's proceedings, and you may now disconnect. Have a nice day.